In this episode, we complete our two-part series on retirement accounts. Today, we are talking company-sponsored plans like the 401k, traditional versus Roth contributions, to max or not, and other things to consider about your plan. Also, we finally get to our bonus section on HSAs, healthcare savings accounts, and why some advisors like these even better than a Roth IRA. All that and more on Real Talk with Real Dads.
We should probably point out we're not CPAs or attorneys or professional investment advisors. As a matter of fact, some of the two of us may have not always made the best financial decisions along the way.
And we don't know your particular situation, so do not use this as investment advice. Consult a pro. I'm pretty sure in my case it's not going to be a problem because most of the people, except for my wife and children, don't listen to my advice on this kind of stuff anyway.
Ditto.
Do you know someone that has a pension?
Well, certainly. I've got a whole collection of folks with sort of different assemblages they've acquired over their lives. Some folks, not many anymore, but certainly some of the other folks, you know, who had the more traditional pensions that you'd see working for the same company throughout their lifetime for their entire career. More recently, my parents have sort of collected pensions, if you will. My mom, for example, retired from two different state teaching systems, which has served her well. I've certainly had friends in the cooperative extension arena who have triple dipped, if you will, between federal, state, and other pensions in their lives.
Right.
And
that's the most common that I know of, right, is the military and state teachers, folks like that.
Yep.
I've got
it. And it's interesting. I'm noting even young kids are getting access to pension accounts now, even with their very first jobs. My daughter worked for a nonprofit youth camp for several weeks last year, and the next thing we know, here comes a statement for her new retirement account.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I've got an aunt that's got one. Most people I know that have them are, like you said, military or government, right? My aunt has one. She is, well into her late 70s. It was my Uncle Bill's. He'd worked construction for the better part of his life. Super valuable for guys like my Uncle Bill who worked construction. These, you know, physical, industrial, farm jobs used people up. By your 50s, at least in his case, he was pretty much physically spent. So he had given 20 plus, maybe 30 years of his life, and then the pension kicks in and takes care of you until you die.
Yeah.
The challenge is they're super hard to manage from the corporate world because even though they're called defined benefit plans, the defined benefit is your life. The rest of your lifetime. So,
right.
So it's
right.
It's hard.
Right. You might have
hard for a company to plan for that. And I thought it'd be kind of cool. I did a little research on this to kind of take a look back into the history of pensions to kind of explain how we got to the current 401k system. So the first ones were in the U.S. offered to soldiers in the Revolutionary War. Come fight for General Washington and you get income for life. Pretty good deal. The feds repeated this offer during the Civil War and has done so ever since. So it's a great benefit, I think, for military families, military service members and their families, and well worth it. The nice thing is the government prints the money. So it's pretty... Yeah. Easy for the government to agree to fund you for the rest of your life. Right.
Although their systems aren't flawless.
Oh, yeah.
To your point, compared to the corporate version, yes, they're far more in charge of the resources to fulfill the promise.
Right. Definitely not flawless. But for companies, the pensions have not fared as well. I'm interested in what your daughter's is. Is it a pension fund, or is it something that they helped launch through some 401k that now she can continue to fund herself? Or do
it's,
they?
It's the latter for all the reasons you're alluding to.
Yeah.
And I think part of the science behind and the technology behind the challenge that you're describing is, you know, we've had some big, you know, advances in medical care. We've had advances right. in the infrastructure to care for the elderly. You know, all of this adds up to an extension of life and the expectation of the life we have at older ages. And, you know, what becomes a living pension, quote unquote, to maybe coin a new term, also just becomes a moving target for folks.
Exactly right. And with lifespans extending, the pension budget goes, you know, out of the world
mm-hmm.
for the corporates, for the private companies. They've just not fared well. So, by the way, I found on U.S. News and World Report, there is still one Civil War pension being paid out. At least as of a couple months ago, I wasn't able to find an obituary recently, so I'm assuming it's still active. There's an 86-year-old Irene Triplett gets $73.13 a month from her father's service in the war between the states.
Yeah, that's amazing.
His name was Moses. Moses Triplett, or maybe it's Mosey, I don't know. Mosey Triplett was from the great state of North Carolina. He was born in 1846. Irene was born when he was 83. Obviously to a younger mother. It was his second wife, and she was 33.
There you go. Interesting.
Old soldiers never die. They just marry younger women. So it was 1875 when Mr. Triplett was 29, by the way, that the first private company offered a pension in the United States. Any idea who that was or any guesses?
No.
They're still rocking today. It is American Express.
Really?
They're not really in the pension business anymore, but they were the first to start it. Hundreds of others followed suit. By the 1960s, nearly half the U.S. workforce was covered under some sort of pension. Employers liked them because there's the 4 o'clock bell. Sorry about that. Employers liked them because it promoted loyalty and low turnover. Vest for 20 or 40 years and get a percentage of your income for life. The American Express plan paid half of each retiree's annual income based on their last 10 years of employment. So this was mm-hmm. this was the so-called defined benefit. You could plan how much income you would have in retirement. Interesting nomenclature, as we said before, because the cost wasn't defined for the company. It was defined for the employee, but not for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And when you bake in like the Civil War case where they pass it on to your dependents, it becomes an even more expensive thing. So we could do several episodes on history of pension plans, but if you fast forward, there are two watershed events. First, the Great Depression comes along. Many companies failed and pensions evaporated because of that. FDR introduces the Social Security Act of 1935. This is the first public retirement plan. Similar to the American Express plan, benefits are based on length of service and average wages. Unlike American Express, though, workers had to pay into the plan. So now the U.S. workers pay more in Social Security taxes than they do in federal income taxes. But mm-hmm. that's a whole different episode.
Well, and around your watershed events, I mean, we could overlay the history of, you know, some of the challenges, anytime you pool a large sum of money, it attracts behaviors that are not always optimal. So there's certainly a history that can be cited in corruption and some affiliation with organized crimes and the unions and so forth, all kind of wrapped up in the same bucket. And not to say that's the norm by any stretch, but there have been instances of that. Fast forward, you now see some large pension funds in their efforts to deploy their assets, because you can't pool these assets and not deploy them to make a return. It's interesting to see the pension funds that are behind some of the largest retail organizations in the world, and especially as some of those large retailers begin to file bankruptcy here post-pandemic, you begin to hear about some of the public pension funds that were a part of the the buyouts and financing of those organizations. Also very interesting to note, it was not but I think a month ago when the California Pension Fund ran into some challenges because the director of that fund was deemed to have very close political ties with the Chinese Communist Party. And it looks like, from the tracking of some of those investments, that in effect, the California Pension Fund may very likely have been invested into Chinese defense contractors, which doesn't make a lot of companies here in the U.S. very happy. So it is just an interesting dynamic that the very fact that you're pooling these massive amounts of capital, and that capital has to find a home and find a purpose, oftentimes leads to some interesting results.
Yeah, I mean, we could do tons of episodes on different pension funds, and obviously the Jimmy Hoffa story is probably the most famous one about corruption, and that was all about union pension funds and managing those monies.
Now, I don't say that to distract from your main point, which is right on the money, no pun intended. These are just mathematically really hard to make work outright for all the reasons we've discussed.
Yeah, it's a great idea, but as with a lot of good ideas, they have to get sort of massaged and improved over time. So the next watershed event come along in about 66 when Studebaker, who was at the time the biggest company in the car manufacturer in the world — I didn't realize they ever were until I did this research. I always thought it would have been Ford or Mercedes or one of those, but this was a large part because they couldn't afford to pay all the retirees the pensions they had promised. So they went bankrupt and thousands of folks were left without pensions. So you've got the stage kind of set for something different. And Social Security had been established. Pensions are wobbly at best. So Congress comes along and starts creating some rules and regulations. ERISA, the Employment Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, to govern how pensions are operated and provide backstops for workers when companies go out of business. But the burden's still on the companies. So obviously workers have to rely on savings of their own in retirement. Then the Revenue Act of 1978 allows workers to set aside a portion of their paychecks into a separate account. It is believed this was a loophole created for wealthy executives to shelter deferred income, but the tax code was silent on the tax treatment of this money. So in 1981, a benefits consultant named Ted Benna noticed this language, asked the IRS for clarification, and sure enough, taxes were not required to be paid on this money. Ted then creates an account through which his company could pay employees via this tax-sheltered account, and voila, the U.S.'s first ever retirement plan was established under Section 401K of the Internal Revenue Code. So I thought that was pretty cool. It was almost by accident.
Well, it is very cool. And something that says every idea has its time. And you alluded to this a little bit ago. The concept behind the pensions was that they were built on a social contract of loyalty to one's employer. And mobility being what it was, both physically and economically, it was not unusual for folks to work for the same firm, the same location for their entire careers, as you pointed out.
Exactly.
This creation of this new vehicle was coming on the heels, as you well cited, of that social contract beginning to break down. And the trust and the loyalty that underpinned that social contract was beginning to break down. So right as this opportunity came forward, think it met up with the fact that the American worker was beginning to realize, I can't necessarily put all my trust and faith into the hands of others, i.e. my employer. And so this new vehicle came along that would require more attention and more input and more responsibility by the worker. There were probably many workers simultaneously coming to those realizations themselves. And I would assume, adoption of this new approach was fairly rapid.
It's really a boom, right? It's only since 81. So what is that, less than 40 years old? Thanks to Ted Benna, employees could voluntarily set aside a portion of their pay into an investment account. And because of the IRS rulings, the funds had not been received and they were not taxed. So this reduced their taxable income. The profits inside the account were not taxed either until they are withdrawn. So for the first time, workers across America could save for retirement on a tax-sheltered basis. And this is before the boom of the internet. Along comes the information age, and it really is setting the stage for this program, this 401k account concept, to really grow. As you can imagine,
having in my own experience an interesting sort of found myself in the middle ground. As a state employee,
right.
I was originally in the defined benefit plan. Due to job changes within the state system, I had a very narrow window to elect on one occasion to instead switch over to the defined contribution plan and then being able to manage, within boundaries and within the plans, what my investments were. However, what I came to find was that public entity had a lot of restrictions upon above and beyond the tax code as to when and how I could access those 401k funds for major life events and other things. So
right.
There's probably a lot of other people out there who might find themselves, if they're switching from one of the more historical models to the more modern model, always pays to ask your ask questions about that fund and understand any restrictions it might have above and beyond what the tax code puts in place.
Right. Very good point. Very good point. So as you might imagine, senior executives saw this 401k not only as a way to save money for their retirement, but as a way to get out of the pension management business for the companies they're running.
Yep.
The money they were spending to start and manage 401k accounts was a tiny fraction of the obligation involved with managing pensions. So fast forward today, 89% of the Fortune 100 companies offer 401ks, only 11 still offer pensions. Pretty dramatic shift.
Yeah, very much so.
62% of Americans have access to 401k plans. I would have thought that was a little higher, but I guess that makes sense. So many people are entrepreneurial and have different gigs. The gig economy may not always present opportunities for the 401k stuff. Americans have $5.7 trillion invested in employer-sponsored 401k plans. Pretty phenomenal.
Wow.
Starting from zero. Starting from zero in 1981 up to $5.7
trillion. Mm-hmm. That's something.
So with privilege comes great responsibility, right? This is a really cool tool to have at your fingertips, but it does require people to get off the sidelines and get educated, either by hiring a really good advisor or learning the stuff themselves. And I came across a really kind of a sarcastic article, tongue-in-cheek a little bit maybe, by Teresa Gilarducci in the New York Times a while back. So I'm going to give it to you here. Not yet convinced that failure is baked into the voluntary, self-directed, commercially run retirement plan system? Consider what would have to happen for it to work for you. First, figure out when you and your spouse will be laid off or be too sick to work. Second, figure out when you will die. Third, understand that you need to save 7% of every dollar you earn. Didn't start doing that when you were 25 and you're now 55? Just save 30% of every dollar. Fourth, earn at least 3% above inflation on your investments every year. Easy, just find the best funds for the lowest price and have them optimally allocated. Fifth, do not withdraw any funds when you lose your job, have a health problem, get divorced, buy a house, or send a kid to college. Sixth, time your retirement account's withdrawals so the last cent is spent the day you die.
Pretty daunting.
So, interestingly, it's gotten a lot better, I think, in the tools that are available to you and the protections that the government provides on 401k plans and administrators. Many employers, including, ironically, Fidelity Investments, who manage retirement accounts, have been sued by their employees over duplicate, hidden, and outrageous fees. So we're a long way from perfect, but today's plans are the best 401ks that have ever been. So it's a good time for our 20-year-olds to be starting out on the 401k journey.
Well, and there has been a great, you know, obviously information is far more available, far more plentiful. Doesn't always mean it's quality information, but certainly there's an ongoing democratization of the tools and information and guidance, as you pointed out, needed to, you know, help folks as motivated, you know, gain the basic skills and basic knowledge to take responsibility for these things.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk mechanics of the 401k, the rules, the regulations, and how to develop and evaluate your options and much more. So let's talk about some of the mechanics and the rules and regulations. By the way, investopedia.com is a good website that has a lot of this material.
Yeah, a lot of good tools there.
So the 401k plan is a company-sponsored retirement account that employees can contribute to. Employers may also make matching contributions. There are two basic types of 401ks, traditional and Roth, which differ primarily in how they're taxed. We've talked about Roth IRAs before, so it's very similar. In a traditional 401k, employee contributions reduce their income taxes for the year they are made, but their withdrawals are taxed. With a Roth, employees make contributions with post-tax income, but can make withdrawals tax-free. It's the old
seed corn. Just one footnote here, Calvin. While most folks certainly do these as a company-sponsored account and avail of themselves thus in the company match, it is possible for folks to set these up independent of their employer and begin to pump monies into as they deem fit.
Right, that's the IRAs we talked about on an earlier episode, right? Just individual IRAs.
Correct.
So as you alluded to earlier, the defined benefit nomenclature, pensions were called defined benefit plans. Conversely, 401ks are called defined contribution plans. These are more aptly named because both the employee and the employer can make contributions up to an annual dollar amount defined by the IRS. So for 2020, the basic contribution limits are $19,500 for employee contributions for workers under age 50, $26,000 per year for employees over age 50, which includes a $6,500 catch-up. Employers may also contribute, and the employee may make non-deductible after-tax contributions. So the max from all sources is $57,000 for workers under age 50 and $63,500 for those 50 and older with the same $6,500 catch-up.
Mm-hmm.
So as you mentioned, the employer match is a key factor in evaluating a 401k. Many companies offer an employer match. Some will match the first 3% contributed to the employee. So you put in 3%, they put in 3%, you get an immediate 100% return. You should always at least do that, right?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, there is a difference across employers. Some will require a minimum percentage they want to see the employee put in. But to your point, I haven't seen many of those that were not then immediately 100% matched. So,
right.
Back to your tongue-in-cheek article from the Gallatin New York Times, when you can guarantee yourself 100% match, but you need to at least get 3% every year, do it. Whatever it takes.
Exactly. That's free money. I mean, I don't like to call it free money because it's part of your compensation, right? It's what the company has set aside for you as part of your compensation package.
If you very true. It's not free money. You're working for it, but it is a 100% return on investment.
Right, and it's free money to the company if you don't claim it. They get to keep it for free.
There you go.
So it's commonly called free money, but I think it's misnamed. It's only free money if you let the company keep your money.
So if that's not motivation enough for you, I don't know what is.
Right. So if you're looking at a 401k plan, figure out at least what the max is or what the minimum is to get your match, and at least do that before you decide about other investment choices. So here's a pro tip. You talked about company requirements. Be careful if you are a super saver like me and our boys who are trying to max these programs out. If your goal, for example, is to max out that $19,500 limit, you may need to time your payments out over the full year. So those are your payments, not the company payments. They don't count towards that limit. Many companies make contributions only during periods when money is taken from your check. So if you hit the 19.5K limit in September, for example, you miss the last 3 months of the year, October, November, December, to receive the company match. So make sure you're maxing the match. And many companies now offer very robust planning tools online to help you see this and plan it out. But it wasn't always that way. Back in my youth, I had a big Excel spreadsheet that we were trying to wring out every single dollar we possibly could get matched before the money was turned off. So again, great time to be alive for these young 20-somethings. Vesting is another feature. Many money contributed by the employer is usually subject to a vesting schedule. After all, the company's investing in you. They want you to be around. The money that you put in is yours to keep. If you leave the employer, the money you put in is still there for you. You may roll your 401k into a new employer company or a company sponsored plan, or roll it into an IRA. We'll talk more on that later. Anytime you're evaluating these things, look at the fees. Sometimes it takes some digging around. As we alluded to earlier, companies have been sued over hidden fees, but you really want to be 1% or less when you're talking fees. And there's a good book that I used to get some of this information out of by a gentleman by the name of Rick Edelman. And he's got some examples in there. If you have something like 4% in fees over 40 years compounded, that can result in $1 million. So,
wow,
definitely worth paying attention to.
Well, I think there's something else you're speaking to here. You know, this issue on vesting. I personally have been in situations where organizations have encountered tough economic times, and you know, I was sitting there looking at 4 years and 9 months into a 5 month vesting period, hoping not to get laid off.
Yes.
Before I crossed that line.
Yes.
Certainly some folks have complained that they have been targeted for reductions in force or layoffs because they were about to cross such lines. So on the front end, you know, ask yourself how long reasonably, you know, that vesting period is. Do you reasonably want to be with that organization that amount of time? Does it legitimately offer you enough career path growth over that duration of time? You know, just put that into your calculus as you consider new opportunities or transition, because certainly there's a heavy price to be paid when you walk away from a good amount of that match, or all of that match even at times, when you're not vested.
Yeah, good advice.
And especially as our younger folks, you know, may have seven different jobs by the time they're 35, according to the data. If that's the case, they're not getting the opportunity to vest in those. And that, you know, that ends up being 12 or 13 years of working life post-college that you could conceivably be walking away from match in.
Well, that's a great point. And that's something we're going to talk about here in a minute when you try to evaluate where you're putting your money. Sadly, it's become almost more of the rule than the exception. You see people in their 50s getting downsized and right-sized, not anymore because of pension obligations, because, you know, as we mentioned, those have kind of been outsourced to the employee through the 401k, but people have healthcare obligations that they qualify for after a certain, you know, 25, 30 years to the company. And, you know, I've had the bad experience of having my wife get right up to like 14 months from full health care coverage and being spun out. They didn't downsize her. They still needed her. They still needed her function and her job, but they spun out her job into a small, smaller company with the exact same work, but they just got out of having to pay her that retirement healthcare obligation, which just really rubbed me the wrong way, but not much she could do about it. Or, you know, she worked there 22 years and they treated her really, really well until that last 14 months. It kind of ticked me off, but it is something to just be aware of and prepare for, and just max out as many of these programs as you possibly can. And be aware of what your opportunities are.
Yeah.
So along those lines, you've got inside a 401k, you're going to have different investment selections, different investment options. One endowment model that I have kind of followed is 80% in a stay rich bucket, 10% in a liquidity bucket, and 10% in a get rich bucket. So your stay rich bucket would be the things that are more defensive, or as we've mentioned before, like the S&P 500, things that you're just going to stay with and be a long-term nice return for you. Your liquidity bucket would be things like cash, CDs, and bonds, and then a 10% get-rich allocation would be more risky things that you might want to try to grow with. That's a pretty common one for endowments. Warren Buffett's model we've mentioned before, his recommendation is, it's always curious to me, advice from Buffett. He gives it, but he doesn't take the same advice. What he recommends is 90% S&P 500 and 10% bonds, which does make some sense inside a retirement fund like this. We follow Dave Ramsey. He's got a 25% each model for mutual funds. He's a big mutual fund guy. And he says growth in income, growth, aggressive growth, and international. And it sounds like a lot of growth to me, but he lays out 20, you know, four different funds to be in and kind of diversify that way. Get help from an advisor. Some companies offer access to these for free or for a small charge. And you and I were talking earlier about target date funds. So this is something that I really like the concept of. When I read more about them, though, they're a little harder for me to understand because there's a question between gradual or cliff, right? When do they start making these adjustments? You know, the idea is when you get closer to your graduation, to your retirement, you're in more safer investments, and they average away from the risky in the safe over that time. But is it a gradual thing or a cliff thing? Like, do they make a big adjustment, you know, the year before you're about to retire? If that's the case, it may be a down year for stocks. You don't want to be selling stocks when they're down. The other question is two or three.
I think you encounter both of those. In my own experience, the target date funds I have used have been on a gradual model. And I think your point is 100% correct. I think, though, one of the advantages of the target date funds is we know historically folks do not, despite the various models and recommendations and the constant chime of, you know, annually reevaluate and rebalance your portfolio, many, many people don't yet do that. And at least with a target date fund, that's automated, right?
Absolutely. You've got professionals doing it for you, which is what I like about it.
Yeah. But to your point, you know, you got to know what those professionals are doing. You can't be entirely hands off. Some of this is automated, but you still need to understand the philosophy and what the implications are for timing.
Right. The other term that Edelman talks about is to or through. Is it up to the target date or is it through the target date that you plan to stop working? So it pays to research what those are. And I've found another great thing about the internet these days is there are so many places where you can go and back test these models. I still really like the old Buffett 90-10.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line, pick an asset allocation that passes the sleep at night test for you and get the facts either on your own or through an advisor to make informed decisions. So let's talk a little about traditional versus Roth. In 2006, Roths arrived as a 401k option. Unlike Roth IRAs, there are no income limits on contributions. So high income earners now have access to the tax benefits of Roths. It's the same calculus we discussed in the IRAs episode. Do you prefer to pay taxes on the seed or taxes on the crops? Can you afford to forego the tax break now in favor of no taxes later? Do you expect to be in a lower tax bracket now or in retirement? Do you plan on using Roth funds as an estate planning tool or just to fund your retirement? None of us has a crystal ball, so the conventional wisdom is to consider spreading funds into both types of accounts. The more options you have in retirement, the better. So if you have access to all these, how do you decide where to spread the money? How much to save and in what vehicle? First, I would recommend the 401k maxing the match at a minimum. Once you've got the so-called free money squared away, then you need to evaluate, is this an efficiently managed fund? In other words, one with low fees of 1% or less. Does your fund offer options that fit your needs? For example, if you like the target date funds, do the target date funds they offer make sense for you? If you want an S&P 500 fund, do they have an S&P 500 index that has a very low fee? Beware, the fees are not always clear. Number two, 401k max out. If your plan is strong, consider a Roth contribution and after-tax contributions. Pro tip, you may be able to roll these into a Roth IRA. So let's say you like your stuff, you like your options, you can max your Roth IRA contributions. I'm sorry, you can max your Roth 401k contributions into your company plan and then immediately roll those into your individual Roth that may have more options, more flexibility, and lower costs.
Mm-hmm.
Step three, I'm probably going to go next with an HSA, and we haven't discussed those yet, but that's coming up at the end of this episode. These are healthcare savings accounts where the contributions are also pre-tax, so it lowers your tax bill. It helps fund your health expenses in the near term if needed. If you're lucky enough not to need the money for health care, it eventually morphs into an IRA.
Yeah, very nice.
And then the fourth level would be a Roth IRA. The fifth level would be a deductible IRA. And then sixth, a taxable account. And then seventh, a non-deductible IRA. That is a recent change for me. I used to think the non-deductible IRA was a really attractive option. Now I've listed six things I would do before I did a non-deductible IRA here. So a ton of info. If you have questions or comments, please call us or email us. DavidLLimmitt@gmail.com is a good way to get to us. You can also leave a message for us on anchor.fm if you want to do an audio message, and we'll be glad to play it on here. Let's see. Oh, let me touch on the HSAs too, because we have mentioned that. This was signed into law by George W. Bush on December 8th, 2003. It is a healthcare savings account, a tax-advantaged account to help people save for medical expenses that high-deductible health plans don't cover. An HSA is owned by the employee and can be funded by both the employer and the employee. Like an IRA, this is owned by you, not the company. So if you change jobs, this goes with you. There are triple benefits to this. First, it is a tax deduction going in. Second, it is a tax shelter that shelters your growth while you compound over the years. It's tax-free withdrawals as long as you are reimbursing yourself for medical expenses. As I mentioned, you own the account. It's not like a flex account where it's use it or lose it. And if you change employers, it stays with you. Here's a pro tip on the HSAs. There are no time limits to claim the reimbursements. So save those receipts, invest the money in a good S&P 500 index, and let it run. If you can cash flow your near-term medical expenses, then decades of growth later, use those receipts to file for reimbursement and start taking withdrawals tax-free from this account. Surveys show that about 27 million Americans have an HSA. Most do not max it out every year, and most draw it down completely every year. So we're talking about a high-class problem here. If you can afford to open one and you don't need the money for healthcare, it becomes a sort of a secret phantom IRA.
Yeah.
Suppose you don't have all the expenses to take out the funds after you're 65 and you got a really nice high balance. Then you can take it out for any reason after age 65, and it just behaves like an IRA where you pay ordinary income tax on the withdrawals. Pretty darn awesome. A phantom IRA on steroids. HSAs, yep, check them out. Cool. So real quick, the details are $3,550 contribution limit for self coverage from all sources. So if you're a single person, your limit is $3,550. If you're a family, you can put in $7,100 from all sources. That's from you and your employer. After you turn age 55, there's a $1,000 catch up that bumps that up to $8,100. So pro tip here, married couples should each open an HSA. That way when they turn 55, they each get the $1,000 catch-up. So you get $2,000 more per year times the $3,550, you could wind up putting $9,100 per year per couple if you could max it out. You must be covered by an HSA-eligible high-deductible health care plan. So that means for individuals, your deductible must be $1,400 or more. For families, your deductible must be $2,800 or more. I found that is not really a high deductible for us. They call them high deductible plans. That doesn't seem that high to me. They're best for younger, healthier people, of course, like every, like almost everything is, with low cost and or wealthier folks who can afford the higher deductibles. It's usually paired by insurance provider, but can be opened on a separate institution. I found out that the State Employees Credit Union will let you open an HSA, much like an IRA. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's just like an IRA. Okay. You manage it, you own it, and if you don't like your employer's options, it's a really cool thing you can do it on your own. What else? Has no other health coverage, is not enrolled in Medicare, and is not dependent on someone else's tax return. You must meet all those requirements to open one. Individuals who are self-employed or unemployed may also contribute to an HSA. There's a once-in-a-lifetime option to roll IRA funds into an HSA in the event of large medical expenses. So where term life insurance exists to protect your heirs against the bust you don't see coming, the IRA to HSA is there to address large medical bills you do see coming. That is, that's a pretty cool feature. It may not be inherited by a spouse. So here's where the details are not as strong as a Roth IRA. It's not as beneficial to a non-spouse heir. Unlike IRAs that retain some of their tax benefits, an inherited HSA is treated as taxable income to non-spouse heirs, aka children. So it's a big taxable event, but it's a high-class problem. As with all those, talk to your financial advisor to help you navigate the rules, because there are penalties, and if you over-contribute, you have to either pay the penalty or the hassle of unwinding it or both. So get help.
Well, and to your point, get help. And I really like how you've laid out the kind of, from your vantage point, the tools you would take advantage of in the order that makes sense to you. We would just encourage folks, you know, throw all those things on the table, work with your advisor. Those and other tools may make more sense in your personal situation in another order. But, you know, what you've presented here is to give folks overall guidance and begin to think about the trade-offs of the tools in the box.
Right. Well said. Your situation is going to be different. I laid out what I think is a good order for me, and your order will, of course, be different. So I mentioned some books here. Let's see. It's called The Truth About Retirement Plans and IRAs by Rick Edelman. Very well written. It's got lots of examples and recommendations on how to think about this. Get a copy or get online and check it out.
Well, let's talk a bit about current events as we wrap up this episode.
Man, let's do. I saw the Johns Hopkins website this morning is showing 1.3 million infected by the COVID virus and 79,000 dead. I did not get the survived number. I don't know if you've got that handy, but it's pretty impressive too. Let's see.
Well, as we were discussing before we began the episode, here in our home state, there are a number of folks tracking infections and beginning to look at survivorship and testing and death rates and so forth. I told you I was very pleased to find that within my zip code here that the death rate thus far has been 0.03%. We are certainly blessed by good health care in our area of the state and the country, which I tip my hat to. It's probably a big contributor to that. But I think it's also emblematic that, as we discussed before, this is a very pocketized, if you will, event. And I do think that we're finding, and we'll continue to find, that, well, as we've discussed before, is very contagious and very problematic for folks with a variety of conditions, that there may be good news on the horizon for us. Certainly, as you look at some of the trends and the curves, you see changes in trajectory, flattening, and even decreases in some of the data, at least I do in my area, and that's very encouraging.
Amen, brother. Yeah, the number I was looking for is 216,000 have recovered. So that's a promising number that we see running across the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Wear those masks.
Well, I'm glad to see. I think we're doing the right thing by beginning to reopen. That doesn't mean personal responsibility and accountability to your own conscience and the care of others is not still required. But I think we've had a healthy conversation, and we'll talk more in other episodes about how this has been handled. But I'm pleased to see folks creatively and responsibly beginning to think about how to reopen their businesses and get the economy restarted. So,
yeah, it is kind of a tough balance to walk, right? You want quality of life, and if you sacrifice all quality of life for numbers on a page, it starts to feel kind of silly. On the other hand, I do think the scientists are correct to advise people to maintain social distance, wear the mask, try to minimize any sort of transmission vectors that you be, especially with older folks and, you know, our grandparents, and keep the faith. This too shall pass.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Well, on another sign of the times, I noted that in a large national survey recently, 73% of colleges and universities are indicating they're going to be open for business come the fall. I've seen some fall football schedules roll out with home games scheduled for September. And, you know, we hope that we don't see a level of resurgence that sabotages those plans. And as you said, if we can keep our wits about us and be careful, hopefully we can get back to a lot of the things we love and value.
That's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out in the fall.
Absolutely. Well, I certainly hope this was helpful for folks. I think this is an incredibly, first of all, very much enjoyed the historical overview. It's a rich amount of information. The sources that the captain's provided here are both time-tested and well-read and definitely worth a read. Interesting to watch in these times some of the more seasoned investors like the Buffetts and Dave Ramsey's and others. They've got models. It's interesting to see how they might modify those or stick with them or just how these new times change some of our understanding of how we should proceed. But the good news is if you're listening to this podcast, you're thinking about these things, that's 90% of the battle. Taking responsibility, taking charge, and jumping in the water. We thank you for joining us.
Well said, my brother. We'll see you next time.
All right. Take care.
Hey, folks. Dave Emmett here. Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, please leave a quick review on iTunes, which will help more people discover Real Talk with Real Dads. If you don't like us, keep it to yourself. Or you could just tell us. Maybe we can make it better. You can send a voice message on the Anchor site or shoot us an email, davidlemmett@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a thought, question, or tip that would benefit our audience, we'll use it on the show. Thanks again. Be well. And remember, if you can't do what you want, do what you can.